This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. For much of human history, people have used plants to treat ailments. The poisonous effects of vegetation can be curative depending on the dosage. A new exhibit at the Lloyd Library called Pick Your Poison explores the healing power of plants, with naturalist Carol Mundy giving a sold-out talk later this month about the medicinal properties of native plants. On our gardening show today, we're going to talk about medicinal botany and the healing power you can find in your own backyard. And of course, our experts are here to answer gardening questions of all kinds. Joining me now are naturalist at the Crow Nose, Carol Mundy. Thanks for being here, Carol.
Glad to be here. Happy to help.
Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent, Sarah Imbus. Welcome back, Sarah.
So good to be here.
And Brick Gardens founder, Dominique Peebles. Thanks for being here, Dominique.
Hey, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
We know you have questions for our experts, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Carol, as I mentioned, people have been using plants for medicinal purposes for thousands of years. What are some of the most common plants we can find in our own backyards and our gardens that we can use as medicine?
Well, I have to remind people that the information I'm giving out, I'm not a doctor. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you the way that they have been used. I'm not telling you to run out and do this on your own. You really need to do your homework. It's not something to take lightly. But there are so many plants. Every plant on the planet has some medicinal use. It's just a matter of finding out how and who used it. And so some of the most common things most folks would certainly know: aspirin. And aspirin is a derivative that comes from the chemicals that was in things like willow. But another wonderful native plant called Queen of the Prairie in the United States, and in Europe, it's called Queen of the Meadow. And so in the talk, we'll talk about that interesting journey on how to find that. But that's one of those kinds of things. But something as simple as the common plantain that grows in your yard that you might be cursing has been used to help ease, a bruise, a wound, a bee sting. And so it's right there. You might be calling it a weed, you mow it over, and yet all those things under your feet have some other value.
Interesting. And some of those remedies use plants that can be poisonous.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
And that's one of those interesting things. If you think about poison and medicine, there's a very fine line between what works and what makes the lights go out forever. So, just getting that fine amount. And doctors, researchers, medical research are doing that now to be able to tease out very specific compounds of drugs, of flowers, of botanically cultivated compounds that are now being teased out for drugs in cancer use because they have very specific targets. So it's one of those kinds of things of knowing that and the testing. It's not like somebody just went out willy-nilly and said, here, try this. Let's see if it cures whatever. There was a saying, I'm sure you may have heard this before, in terms of mushroom hunters. There's old mushroom hunters and there's bold mushroom hunters, but there's no old bold mushroom hunters. So it does involve a lot of research, doing your homework and not taking it casually.
And where can people find reliable, correct information about medicininal botany? Because it sounds like there are ways to really do it wrong.
There are many ways to do it wrong. And I would say, number one, Cincinnati has one of the finest libraries and museums. The Lloyd Library and Museum has such an excellent collection. And so many of what they have is now been digitized. But when you go to their website, you can also have access to the medical pharmacological botanics that have been used throughout history, because you can tie into that from all over the world. And now you can be doing the research. Again, not everything you read on the internet is true, so make sure you start with a good, justified, vetted resource. But the Lloyd is right here, and we need to use it more often. That's one of the first places that I start.
How many of you mentioned scientific studies and how some of these plants are being looked at for cancer treatments and things like that. How many of these remedies that have been used for centuries have had modern scientific studies to kind of prove their claims? I mean, I know there's, modern medicine obviously
sure.
has developed drugs like aspirin from a lot of these plants.
Sure.
But
then there are plants like echinacea that some people swear, oh, I take this every cold and flu season.
And it works for me.
Does it work for you? Well, but there I'm are saying, scientific studies.
But they will say it works for me. Right. And yet if you talk to the scientists, they may say doing those double blind studies that they're not seeing, that maybe it's the placebo effect.
Right.
It's kind of like if I'm not feeling good and I have a hot toddy, look at what goes into a hot toddy. I usually feel a little better. Is it really the botanicals from, you know, the honey and whatever lemon and botanically alcohol that I might put in there? Or is it just the fact that it's the ritual of heating that up and having that warm and it feels good on my throat?
Yeah.
So some of that is the placebo effect for sure. But in any given time, the pharmaceuticals that are out there are more than 40% plant-based. That's where they started.
Okay. Yeah, I tried echinacea when my late father-in-law insisted, oh, I love it. It works for me. And it just gave me daisy burps. I didn't feel like it did much for me.
It did.
From
a
medical standpoint. Carol, if somebody wanted to start a medicinal garden, what would you recommend?
Again, first do your homework and consider which direction you want this to go. Are you looking at it from a historic point of view? There are places that you can go and visit that have historic gardens that will show you plants that have been used that way. Our own governor's mansion here in the state of Ohio, the Heritage Gardens there at the governor's mansion in Bexley, has the Lloyd Medicinal Garden. And you could make a trip up there. You have to make an appointment, but you could go and see what they're utilizing there and then look at the research that they have put together. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are plenty of places that you can go and questions to ask to find out about these. And then the next thing would be, will those plants grow here? That's always the biggest thing, because you may have some wild, wonderful, what you think of as the curative, but it may not grow here in southern Ohio or northern Kentucky.
Yeah. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today with a panel of experts to answer your questions. If you have questions, we know you do, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. I want to get to an email that we got yesterday because Mary is desperate for an answer. Mary writes, what the heck can I do about permanently ridding out the nutsedge amongst my creeping phlox and other garden perennials? I'm at my wit's end. I'm going to start with you, Sarah.
All right. So this is a lovely conversation starter to what is a weed? Okay, so when I first read this, you know, she identifies that it was amongst creeping phlox and other garden perennials. So by definition, a weed is just a plant out of place. So for example, recently in our perennial bed, some of our echinacea just blew over to another space and was nicely nestled in between a few other plants, and it was overcrowding those other plants that were purposely planted in this particular spot in our pollinator garden. And so we have to make the decision. We haven't done it yet. And I think some horticulturalists, if not all gardeners, sometimes you're like, oh, what do I do? At what point? Because the buds are beautiful. They're about to bloom. So, but then it's going to outcompete the other desirables in this space. So we're going to have to make the decision. And I think we'll have to. And again, this is a simple little echinacea, but it's like all these plants are little babies, right? And so we're going to have to remove that, transplanted into a desirable, or share it amongst our friends, our other gardening friends. So again, I say that because looking at that picture, that echinacea in our garden space would be technically a weed, right? So someone say, well, how? What are you going to do with that echinacea? Well, we're just going to lift it up and transplant it and share it, or put it back in another space desirable amongst the other echinaceas, right? So I say that because, again, nutsedge is just a plant out of place. So in this space, it definitely is a weed amongst the phlox and other perennials. So for those of you who have had similar situations of this, and maybe even in your lawn, nutsedge is very obnoxious and and how to get rid of it. So there are mechanical, chemical ways to eradicate it. But as prior to the show, I was speaking with Carol here, and you know, going back and thinking about plants botanically, So nutsedge also has a medicinal use. I'm not sure which cultures, but I have heard that. So the reproductive part of the nutsedge, not only the seed, but under the ground, the nuts, they're little tubers. And some of you who have tried to hand pull them probably have said a few vulgar words as you try to do
that. We won't say on the radio.
Exactly. Because it's similar to a dandelion that has a taproot, which also has medicinal use. You know, you're not helping the situation, if you will, by hand pulling it a lot of times, because it's just further helping it propagate or helping it to spread its wealth, if you will. But nutsedge has a medicinal use. So before we get to that, Carol, so if you are wanting to get rid of sedge ender, or excuse me, I just told the chemical. if you're wanting to get rid of this, quote, weed nutsedge in your perennial garden or in your lawn, there are, like I said, chemicals that you can use. Always read the label, no matter if they're synthetic or organic, because the label is the law. And there are methods that you can use. And some of the listeners may realize that one of my best ways, or my favorite ways, when any weed is immature, is I get my weed torch out, which I had out a few days ago. And you can just burn that foliage to prevent photosynthesis and any further development of that plant. But as the plant is maturing and growing and establishing seeds and its root structure below the soil, mechanical or maybe even other best management practices might not rid of this issue. And also some chemicals you can't use in your garden beds the same as you would use in your turf. Again, read the label. The label is the law. So sedge ender is one that you could use with the active ingredient. I don't care about the brand name. It's all about the active ingredient, sulfentrazone. So that is one way, and one chemical, synthetic chemical, that you can use. But there is other best management practices for all different types of weeds. It's also understanding their life cycle, right? Are they an annual or perennial? When are they a winter or summer? So it's understanding their life cycle and then implementing best management practices in your space. I think that's the... I would like to end there, and then do we have time to chat about
Carol, would you like to make the case for the nutsedge?
Sure. Well, I'm not saying that I'm not going to pull it or pull it out. I'm just saying it has this other life.
Right.
And even though you or I might be offended by it, and you certainly know anybody who's in the turf industry, you see their hands shake if you mention the words yellow nutsedge. But this is an edible. This is the tiny little tuber that it produces. And by the way, Florida has the biggest production of nutsedge for food in the United States. So it's an agricultural crop. But it's listed as the name chufa. Mm-hmm. And they sell these wonderful little tubers. They're dried. They look kind of like a piece of dried up coconut. They kind of taste that way as well. But they're ground or pressed. So if you think about making almond milk or any other kind of nut milk, they'll press those to make that fluid the same way that then goes into your smoothie or into your horchata or whatever type of drink you want to make. The nuts themselves are ground and used as a replacement for wheat flour. So if you have a gluten problem, you can utilize the chufa flour in placement of that. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's one of those things where I'm not saying I'm not going to kill it necessarily, but I want people to realize that it has this other life. Mm. It didn't come over here as this bad, mean, to attack you. It actually has this other life.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Maybe you're scared if you eat the babies. We have a caller on the line. Hi, Angela. Thanks for calling. What is your question?
Yes, this is the second year I've grown one tomato plant, and then I also have several jalapeno plants. They're all in pots. And everyone says the tomato needs a lot of water. And I've been doing a lot of water, but what is considered a lot of water?
Okay, how much water does that tomato plant need? Dominique, I'm going to throw this one to you.
Good question. So there's a couple of things that jumped out at me. You said you're growing the tomato plant in a pot. So when you're growing it in a pot, really, you just want to touch the soil. Make sure, like, if you dig down in it a couple of inches, does it still feel moist? If not, then it's time to water it. Also, tomato plants, their roots run as deep as they can go. So you may be watering it in the pot, and then because of the pot might not have proper drainage, you'll see it start to fill up with water, and then you'll stop thinking that it's got enough water. But as you sit there and wait, the water's going down, you may not be getting to all of the roots if you don't water it enough. The other thing is tomato plants really don't like to be in pots, to be honest. A lot of people aren't going to like to hear me say that, but the way their roots grow, they really reach out. They go deep. So once they get to that point to where they can't expand any longer, it's going to stop fruiting the same way or growing to the height that it can if it's in the ground. So my best suggestion is, if you haven't watered it within a day, go out there, fill around in the soil, and then let that tell you.
Okay. Does that help?
I've been watering it, but sometimes if I feel like I didn't do enough, the leaves start kind of crawling up in late afternoon, mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh, I guess it wasn't enough today.
Is that a sign?
Of looking at it when the leaves kind of curl up and then they pop back up?
So the leaves, so that could be a couple of factors. Like the leaves could just be curling up because of the stress of the day, depending on how hot it is and stuff like that. We've had kind of a pretty interesting spring. So if it's outside and you're watering it, also keep in mind that just over the last week or so, it's been really the driest it's been for me all spring. So it might be a situation of you overwatering it, because if it was raining the last couple of weeks and you didn't need to go out and water your plant. So if you went a day and then went and watered it, you might have overstimulated it a little bit. But most of the times the leaves will curl up a little bit during the day. That could come from a lot of things, mainly the stress of the heat of the day. And then what you'll notice is later in the night, they'll start to kind of fan out and start looking a little bit happier. But that's things that happen just throughout the day. So if you have it sitting directly in the sun and it got really hot, even if you're watering it, it can still curl up on you and then relax later in the day.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Angela. We appreciate your call. That's like me. I kind of curl up during a stressful day at work and then I relax once I'm home at night and it gets cooler. Well, we're going to continue our gardening show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today, and we have a panel of experts here to answer your questions. My guests are naturalist at the Crow Nose, Carol Mundy, Campbell County Extension Office horticulture agent, Sarah Imbus, and Brick Gardens founder, Dominique Peebles. If you've got questions, and we know you do, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Sarah, let's talk about what kinds of pests and diseases do we need to watch for in our gardens this time of year?
Right now I've started to see aphids, both on ornamental crops as well as our vegetable crops. So those are pesky little pests that their mouth part, similar to weeds, insects have a whole other life cycle. It's very interesting to understand their feeding habit. So when you're trying to figure out why do I got all these holes everywhere? Why does it look like something's chewing on? That is telling me the mouth part, right? And so aphids have a piercing mouth part. It reminds me of a needle, similar to that of the brown marmorated stink bug. Yeah. And so that's super helpful. And we really like to use biological controls when possible. So for example, we have aphids that are currently on a lot of our ornamental alliums. And so that really prevents bloom and the overall growth and health of the plant. So yesterday, I actually had a group of children in the garden, and guess what I saw there? I saw some ladybugs.
Yay.
So that's telling me that our lovely little ladybugs, I don't know, this always fascinates me of, you know, when there's a population of our pests and then it like sends up an alarm to all of our beneficial insects and then the party comes. Mm-hmm. And so I saw one and I bet if I go out there today, because the population of the pest, this case, the aphid, you know, one could probably take care of the job. And then when the population of our beneficials dominates that pest, then they move on, you know. So sometimes like our growers, they'll put a cheesecloth over a certain crop that they're trying to completely eradicate. So then, you know, when you buy in these beneficials, for example, they're not just flying away, right? You get your bang for your buck.
There's no leads on those, no leashes on those little ladybugs.
I always tell, especially our youth, you know, let's be respectful to insects. And because we don't understand, some folks may not realize that the immature of a ladybug looks completely different than what the adult looks like. And so to me, that's fascinating to teach our youth, similar to that of a larvae of a monarch butterfly. Most people know what that is because that's like the symbol of pollinators, right? Which, by the way, is pollinator month. This month. And so we just have to be mindful of wildlife, of the ecosystem and their life cycles and their host plants. But I know I'm getting off topic, Lucy.
No, that's great.
So I really have started seeing that. I've seen some disease pressure on our tomatoes, early blight. So just keep in mind that early blight is a foliar fungi that really focus early in the season, early blight, and it starts to discolor or sends these growth patterns in a circular fashion on the lower limbs. But like tomatoes, for example, I'm limbing up or pruning. So I've already pruned twice. And so I'm allowing better airflow. I'm watering, focusing on the root system. So I'm also understanding the disease pressure and how to implement environmental practices to reduce. So like nut sedge, they love the water. So in certain areas, I'm holding back on watering. and over time, amongst other best management practices, it slowly reduces that population, right? So, okay, get back on pests. But I think that I haven't seen many, to be honest. Now, I've seen a lot of bunnies. I've talked to some gardeners, and I've seen a lot of bunnies. And bunnies are just hopping around, and so we're used, and they get our zinnias right when they're about to open, and I'm like, and so we have some community gardens. Dominique, I don't know if you've seen this either, but they're finding their way in and ate our sweet potatoes, ate our kale, greens. It's heartbreaking.
I've had rabbits get up in raised beds, 30-inch raised beds.
I don't get it.
When I was working within a public garden, they would basically know when the staff went home, and they would get up on the bench that was next to this raised bed garden area. You know, if you happen to stroll through half an hour, 45 minutes later, there they are, like, closing time. We got it to ourselves. So.
Wow. For sure. Okay. Well, we have a caller on the line. Hey, Larry, thanks for calling. What is your question or comment?
Good afternoon. Love your show. Love the station. I will tell you, it kept me alive between 2016 and 2020, hearing the truth. So, but I digress. I was at a big box store today and in the garden section, and they are suddenly selling orange trees and lemon bushes and lime bushes, and I thought that because we're above the hemisphere, like above North Carolina, that those are no-nos due to frost issues. I wonder if you're aware of some new frost resistant plants that have come on the market.
Great question, Larry, and thanks for your kind words. Dominique, are you familiar with any frost-resistant orange trees or lemon and lime bushes?
I'm not to say that there isn't any out there, but I currently don't know where to buy them at. I do notice that a lot of big box stores are starting to sell all types of fruit trees and things like that. And the few people that I know that have bought these fruit trees, it's some of them are literally keeping them in their house or in a greenhouse if they have one. And then just bringing them out in the summertime. The thing with that is they're only going to get to the size that they're at, right? They're not going to grow any bigger than that, having to keep them in those pots that you buy them in, or even if you put it in a bigger pot and just move it out, you know, in the season. But, you know, I don't know if it's more of a gimmick or a hobby that people are doing that or selling those types of trees. Like I said, the ones that I know, people are doing it as a hobby and they just bring them in and out. We do have a Meyer lemon tree in the greenhouse, but even with it being in the greenhouse, it's still in a big, huge pot.
Yeah.
I think I've gotten one lemon off of it maybe in the last 4 years,
and that was
the first year.
Yeah.
Right. So me personally would, you know, save your money and spend it on something else. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah. Carol, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I'm right there with Dominic in that I think it is one of those hobby kind of things. I want to see if I can grow, you know, fill in the blank. And you do have people who are so dedicated to that, that they will buy the absolute most gigantic pot that they can and put it on coasters and wheel it in and out over the season. And they're so proud, like he is, when they got the first lemon. Woohoo!
Didn't know it was the only lemon.
Right. And so my feeling about some of these that are really far out of their area in terms of growing to production is they become a very large annual. Let's put it that way, because they're not going to survive outside. They might look really lush in our crazy dog day summers. But guess what? Come October, and it might be late October now when we get those cold days, it's not going to be happy.
Yeah.
It won't survive the winter outside.
Yeah. Shout out to my late grandma Grody. She had a beautiful little lime plant that she kept in her bay window, and she got tiny little weird looking limes that I remember. So any of my cousins listening out there, call us and give us your grandma Grody lime bush memories. But Larry, thank you so much for your call. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Dominique, what are you doing in your garden these days? Especially, I was reading that this is the time of year when birds are really going after berry bushes. And are there things that you're doing in your garden to protect berry bushes if you have those? Or what's up in your garden these days?
So everything in our garden potentially gets attacked, not just by birds, but we definitely had an interesting spring with the rabbits and bunnies as such also. Now, as far as the birds go, we do have a cherry tree that's in our one of our gardens. We have raspberry bushes and stuff like that. But also, luckily, we also have like those mulberry trees and stuff in some of our spaces. So the birds typically go attack that stuff and leave the other things alone. But if we do see extra attention on the raspberry bushes, we will put nets over it and stuff like that for a little bit. But for the most part, we typically like to just coexist with nature and see what it tends to leave us to sharing as well. But nets, or we have netted the cherry tree before, and we did that this season because we were just slightly preparing for potential cicadas and stuff like that that never or hasn't showed up. So those are things that you can do to protect your fruit plants and fruit trees and stuff like that.
Okay. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We got an email from Susan in Anderson Township. Susan writes, I have a whole hillside of daylilies, but they don't bloom. They get a lot of sun. I bought special fertilizer for daylilies from Brex, but that didn't help. I inspected them yesterday, and there's only one flower spike. What can I do to get them to bloom? Sarah, do you have thoughts for Susan?
Yeah, so first thing I would do is inspect the tubers. And so sometimes there are pests that get inside the tubers that prevent them from, which is their root system, prevent them from blooming. So I would check that first.
You just have to inspect a sample daylily?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Some, you know, daylilies, ditch daylilies, for example, they do well in kind of boggier areas. And, you know, they could be there for 10 years, you know, and all of a sudden they just stop blooming. Well, they're just so clumped up together and they just need to be nicely divided and shared or moved around a little bit to give a little bit more space. So pest, just overall compaction of your each one, I guess, or clump that you may have. So I would check those two. And also, don't over-fertilize. Just keep in mind that those three numbers on the fertilizer bag, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, nitrogen is great for green growth. So I talk a lot about this, too, when speaking of tomatoes, for example. I get lush green growth, but then no flowers. And I'm like, well, what are you fertilizing with? Well, looking at that fertilizer bag, same thing goes with your daylilies, making sure that the N, that first number, is low, okay, once we get that foliage, because we want phosphorus and potassium to go down into the roots to help with root development and flower and fruit production. Same thing goes with our edibles, too. So just be mindful, and that also goes with our vine crops as well. So, and also, if you have any specific questions, email me, because sometimes looking at pictures, there could be virus too. If you see any striations, that's also irises. They get spider mites and some pathogens that affect flower bloom. So pictures sometimes help me to visualize and then better help with that situation. So my email's up on the website.
Yep, right. Yep. And we can, Susan, if you need an email, need to connect with Sarah's website, send an email back to us and we will make that connection for you.
Fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Carol, what are you doing in your garden these days?
On any given day, well, you're always on the patrol. I have a outdoor veggie garden raised bed, but then my wonderful husband built a cage around it. It's in
the
only
sun. Bunnies out?
The bunnies, yes. Now, I still have problems with occasional mice, a few smaller chipmunks, and a shrew once in a while.
Mm.
And I still have pests, like when you were talking about that the other day, the slugs were easy on to the lettuce and the broccoli, mm-hmm. you know, so their slug patrol go out there and squish the buggers. And I just found my first cabbage worm. It's like, dang it.
Yes.
So, but I, you know, every day is an inspection. You go out and you're either watering, you're staking something up, you're looking at the flowers. You just learn so much, I think, when you have your eyes and your hands on from day to day. And I don't care if it's a tomato in a pot or you decided to grow the potatoes that were sprouting in the pantry. You put them in a, you know, bin outside. The fact that you're doing that hands-on and you see the difference from day to day, water, no water, too much sun, not enough, the creepy crawlies, the value of that education, you can't get any better than that. So every day is just an adventure. I always call myself the reluctant gardener. I teach master gardeners, but I'm not a master gardener. I'm a reluctant gardener. And I go out there and spend some time. Most people would say she's just fooling around out there.
What do you do, Dominique? Do you agree with that? Is that daily inspection important? What are you looking for when you're out in your gardens?
Yeah, I smirked a little bit because I was thinking that is spot on. I mean, that's most of the job. I mean, I've gotten ahead of the weeds and such and stuff like that. And even stuff that I think is a weed now, and years later, I find myself making sure it's not a beneficial weed, like we were speaking about at the top of the show. But it is a daily job. It is inspecting your garden to see what's different from one day to the next. Try to get an understanding of what path the squirrels are coming down to yeah. bite the heads of corn, like, you know, stuff like that. So you can always try to find a way to mitigate something. And one thing that I always tell people when whatever type of gardener you are, because, you know, I'm always reluctant to call myself a specialist or a master anything, but write everything down. Write everything down and then have patience, because what's hard for me is I'm impatient. So when I started this season and I found all the 10 things that I did wrong and that I can fix them, I started thinking, how do I wait another season before I can enact this the right way? Right. So it's one of those things that, it, you know, you got to spin it and give yourself something to look forward to. Like, I'll do it right this summer versus how I did it last summer. So mm-hmm. it is a daily lesson that you're constantly being taught. And even when you're not looking for the lesson, it's right there in your face.
That's right. Good to keep a journal. Well, we will be back after another quick break to wrap up our gardening show. Now is the time to... Now's the time to call with your questions. Call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're wrapping up today's gardening show. My guests are naturalist at the Crow Nose, Carol Mundy, Campbell County Extension Office horticulture agent, Sarah Imbus, and Brick Gardens founder, Dominique Peebles. Now's the time to call with your questions or comments, 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We do have a caller waiting. Hi, Loretta. Thanks for your patience. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have two. How do I get rid of English ivy from the landscape?
Good question. I have some. Sarah looks exhausted just thinking about that question. Go ahead, Sarah.
I think Dominic said it before, patience. there's many different applications to implement in your space. And they can get fairly large in diameter. They could even creepy crawly around trees. In that instant, never pull out away. You could hurt yourself. Branches can fall down, but you're also hurting the tree as well. Large caliper, you might need an axe or maybe a hand saw to kind of break that, that development stage. And so you might have to, not as crazy as like poison ivy and maybe even some of the honeysuckle, but you might even think about doing some application of chemical, synthetic, or organic. So that is an option. If it's in a landscape, I really, really try to find, because if you've noticed, it's vines, right? And so I really try to find its, quote, mother plant, where it's coming, and then I try to remove it. So I have a space that I, next to our building at the office, and I've tried to mow it down, try to, what's called, burn it down. And I've tried multiple applications of mowing it, and I'm like, oh, I got it. And then I'm like, no. So that's a mechanical way, with our mower. I'm like scalping it, right? Yeah. And then I'm also mechanically removing it with a hand trowel, trying not to use any type of chemical. I think we got it. There's still some coming up. And then I'm replanting. So I don't want to leave that bare, right? So with any type of invasive species removal, you don't want to leave that space bare, right? And so I'm going back in with a nice ornamental grass that could fill in that tiny little space where the the ivy has taken control. So I hope that is helpful. Now, every space could be, other management practices can be implemented. So a hillside, for example, or, you know, grass or whatever it might be. So if you have a particular situation that this has not been helpful, send me a picture and email, because that helps me, again, I'm a very visual learner, to see what is going on in your particular environment.
Yeah. Thanks, Loretta. Did you have one more question for us that we could ask real quickly, because we've got some calls piling up?
Yes. Yeah, real quick. A vine is tangling into a dogwood. How do I extricate it from the tree?
So right. Very similarly, you never want to pull, right? And so I would take a pair of pruners, a handsaw, something, and find where the root system is coming up through the ground, and you want to, in a sense, cut that off, right? And so over time, it's going to dehydrate, it's going to die, and then it's either going to naturally fall down, or, you know, it's going to not be twined up. That could potentially hurt you, like pulling some branches down along with it and hurting yourself. So never pull from a tree. And so that's the suggestion I would do, is do that now. And depending upon, the girth or the diameter of that, you might have to continuously going back if any new little suckers develop.
Okay. Thanks so much, Loretta. We do have a number of callers waiting on the line, so we might need a lightning round now. Hey, Barb, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. First of all, I learned so much from you all, and I love this show.
Oh, thank you.
I'll get to my question. My neighbor has some very old wisteria that has not been maintained, and it has come up in my yard, and many places, and I can't seem to get rid of it. I have found roots that are as big around as my arm. I don't know what to do to keep it out of my yard.
Good question. Sarah looks exhausted again. Sarah.
So this is just a plant out of place, right? So in your situation, it's become a nuisance or a weed, right? And so if it's a space where you can mow continuously, again, you're trying to suffocate it. You're trying to prevent it from collecting energy, photosynthesizing to store that into the root system. Ideally mechanical. If you can hand remove, you might need to combine that method with chemical use.
Right.
So again, when I say chemical use, again, organic or synthetic, it does not matter. I will spot treat. So I'm not willy-nilly going out there and just spraying. I'm conscientious about the environment, so the temperature, the wind, and then I want to make sure that is specific to that. So for example, for that, I would use a non-selective, because a broadleaf weed herbicide that you may have in your garage is not going to treat a woody perennial. So you're going to have to choose an herbicide that is labeled for that. So a woody perennial, a non-selective. So keep in mind, because if this is amongst desirable plants, shrubbery, turf, non-selective means it's going to kill anything and everything. So you might have to protect things, or there are certain nozzles that you can put on the end of your sprayer. So, or there are other methods that you can prevent drift or those little sprinkles of herbicide to get around. So conscientious about, again, wind, weather, humidity is huge. Morning application is typically best for most herbicides or any chemical, even fertilizers. So just be mindful. Again, reach out if you have specific questions.
Thanks, Barb. I hope that helps. We now have Chris on the line. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm trying, for the last 2 years, I've been trying to get rid of gooseneck flowers. And I'm kind of at my wit's end. So I don't know what to do.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry that they're giving you such trouble. Do either of you have thoughts about gooseneck flowers?
Chris, would you describe the plant for us? Because that common name's not ringing a bell.
So yeah. they grow probably about 3 feet tall, and then they have a white flower at the top. Well, it's comprised of lots of flowers, but it's sort of in the shape of a gooseneck. And it's
gotcha.
Sort of
yeah.
big, you know, it's like big around on one end, and then it goes into like a little cone.
And you're fighting this because it's just taking over.
Invasive, yeah. It's
yeah.
Like, I mean, like it's the only thing left in my flower bed.
I think that goes back to what Sarah was saying a little bit ago, is that you certainly can do the mechanical use where you're either chopping it back or mowing it, but you also may have to go into some chemical means and utilizing a way where you're not, you know, following all the directions, the time of day, protecting other areas. Some of these plants, not the gooseneck, but I was thinking about the big ivies, especially or the wisteria, you could have that dauber, get the herbicide that's in a dauber head, like you use for bingo markers. And that way, when you cut it, you're just getting chemical on that one space. But it's not going to happen overnight. And like she said, when you finally do get it, then you have to work quickly to put something back in there. Because if you don't, Mother Nature will fill it up with something else you don't want. I know that's not exactly the answer you're hoping for. There's no, you know, magic fairy dust you can make it erase from the environment, but I think it's just one of those things you have to work at.
Yeah. One other quick thing I want to just share, especially when there's that beautiful flower of anything. So this loosestrife, which is another common name, okay? So you want to remove that flower head before it goes to seed. So that's even you know, dandelions, for example. So that is preventing that life cycle from continuing. So yes, this takes patience and it's a multiple applications, for example, but that's going to be huge, is to remove that seed head.
Yeah. Thanks for that call, Chris. We appreciate it. Hope that helps. Hi, Danny. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
I have grown, planted some cone flowers about 5 years ago, and they're absolutely gorgeous. Like, they come in real thick and vibrant. I don't know the right time by looking at them or the season or part when to cut them back to encourage new growth. Thanks for your taking my call, and I'll take your answer offline.
Okay, thanks, Danny. Thoughts for Danny, Sarah?
Yeah. So really, I think this was Echinacea, right?
He said coneflower,
which is a pretty big, you know, that's a broad term, but that's what I would go with. Yeah.
Okay. So they should be budding out now, or you might see some of them multiple branched out with nice stems in a new node or where that flower is going to be developed. So if you want to encourage, a lot of them don't need to be cut back, if you will, because they're just going to be continuous bloomers. Now, if you would like, you can cut the spent flower back, but here's another food for thought. It's a great food source for finches and other birds. So in our garden, I keep those up even all the way to the fall. And then once all the seed heads have been collected by mainly finches, for example, then I go ahead and I remove those flower stems all the way down to the soil surface. I mean, honestly, 2 inches above the soil surface, and that should be good. So it is herbaceous, so it will die all the way back to the ground. So I hope that is helpful.
Great. And we have, let's see, we have Mike on the line. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for calling.
Hey, how are you doing there? I had a question about my hedges that seems to have an overgrowth of honeysuckle in the middle of it, and it keeps growing, seems like, overnight. I hate to keep trimming it back every other day, it seems. Is there any way that I can eradicate that?
Wow, that is a question for the ages, Mike.
Yeah.
So I'm
word of the day, patience.
Yeah. So I'm just visualizing in my mind when you say that I have some boxwood hedges, and you know, there's a little honeysuckle that comes up because of a bird or some other wildlife might have transferred that seed into that space, and it's just poking right up through the middle. I would, if possible, get on your hands and knees and try to find the trunk and try again, similar to the English ivy or these other noxious vines growing elsewhere. You want to cut that at the base as close as you can. And then I buy full concentrated non-selective herbicide and I use a paintbrush and I dab it on that wound, preferably the same day so it's not callousing over. You know, if it's just one little one, you might even be able to take a trowel and you might be able to remove that whole root system. But if it's like a whole grove and honeysuckle, they have like all these little finger-like, I guess, root systems that go through the soil. So that might be a little difficult. But if you just have one, sometimes you don't even need to use chemical. You just cut. You might have to use a shovel and remove that. So, yes, that it can be very annoying. You know, some of our other trees that become a little a nuisance in between some shrubbery, one little seed head gets down in there and it becomes, you know, its own little ecosystem.
Yeah. When you said get down on your hands and knees, I thought you were going to recommend prayer for a minute.
That helps too.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that call, Mike. We have run out of time. Sorry we didn't get to you, Eric, but I've been talking with naturalist at the Crow Nose, Carol Mundy, Campbell County Extension Office horticulture agent, Sarah Imbus, and Brick Gardens founder, Dominique Peebles. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, you can find more information about the Lloyd Library's Pick Your Poison exhibit and associated events on our website, wvxu.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.